Welcome to Thursday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are grateful that you are with us today. We have a packed show coming up in just a bit. Learning Takes Flight. We'll talk about aviation adventures at North Dakota's Gateway to Science and a new segment here on Main Street, Tech with Peck. My longtime friend George Peck will make technology simpler for all of us to understand, and we'll meet George today. Plus, News Director Dave Thompson and I will review the news. This is a closer look with the monitor on Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. A ballot measure headed for the November election is now facing a constitutional challenge that could stop it before voters ever see it. The issue centers on legislative term limits approved by voters just a few years ago and whether lawmakers overstepped their authority by placing a new measure on the ballot that would loosen those limits. Joining us to discuss is Mary Stoyer. She's a government and politics reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. She's been following the lawsuit now before the North Dakota Supreme Court, and she'll help us understand what's being argued and why it matters and what could happen next. Mary, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
Mary, let's start with the basics. What's the lawsuit about and who's bringing it?
So the lawsuit accuses the state legislature of undermining a 2022 term limits constitutional amendment. And the main impetus of the lawsuit was a resolution that the legislature adopted in 2025, Senate Resolution 4008. And that resolution sort of followed the constitutional amendment that passed on the ballot and included some little tweaks that the legislature wants to refer to voters to approve in November. So the plaintiffs of the suit are two men who were on the sponsoring committee of the term limits amendment. They helped work put that on the ballot. And they are former lawmaker from Minot, former Senator Ole Larson, and then a Grand Forks County Commissioner whose name is Terry Bierke.
We'll get into exactly what Senate Resolution 4008 tried to do or tries to do here, but take us back to 2022. What did voters approve? What did we approve when we passed the original term limits amendment?
That amendment, Article 15, makes it so that state lawmakers can serve no more than 8 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate. And when it passed on the ballot, it passed with 63% approval from voters. The whole idea behind it is to try to keep people from spending decades upon decades in the legislature and to encourage a more diverse set of people, maybe younger generations, to join the state house.
Mary, what was your feeling on why those term limits were significant in our state at that time now, almost, 4 years ago?
There's a sort of tension between the legislature and the public who supported the amendment, because although few people have come out against the idea of trying to encourage new people to join the state house, there's a concern that the limits will push institutional knowledge out.
Institutional memory. We hear that often. Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then not really provide incentives for new people to come in. We have a citizen legislature, so it's really hard to get people who have the resources and the time to join the state house. So there's some concern that it'll push people who have a lot of institutional memory to contribute out the door without really having adequate replacements for them. And then it also, lawmakers had some heartburn about the very strict 8 years in either chamber rule too.
So walk us through then Senate Resolution 4008. What are those tweaks that you talked about just a moment ago that are trying to be made?
So the changes don't change the net amount of years that lawmakers can spend in the legislature, but it does say that they don't have to do up to 8 years in the House and up to 8 years in the Senate. It allows them to spend those 16 years wherever they want. So they could max out 16 years in one chamber and then spend no years in the other, or, you know, they could do 12 in one and four in the other, etc. And then another change is that they specify that incomplete terms or partial terms don't count against your term limit.
And all of this Mary, was it your feeling was because of this worry that institutional memory was leaving the North Dakota legislature?
The other part was just to clarify potential ambiguities, or lawmakers perhaps felt that the 8-and-8 rule was an unnecessary restriction.
All right, let's get to the core constitutional dispute. If we can, the lawsuit argues the legislature violated the Constitution. What specific constitutional language are the plaintiffs now pointing to?
There are two different provisions that they accuse the legislature of violating. The first one, I think, is the most obvious one, which is that in Article 15, it specifically says the legislature cannot propose a change to Article 15, messing with the term limits. And so the plaintiffs in their complaint say, well, this resolution specifically proposes a change to an amendment that the amendment itself says shouldn't be possible. Therefore, we're, bringing this to the Supreme Court. And then the other one is in a different part of the Constitution. It says that when a policy change is approved on the ballot, the legislature may not amend that change for 7 years unless they clear a two-thirds majority in both chambers.
Lawmakers and legislative council now say the resolution is constitutional. What's their argument?
Their argument, although they haven't filed a official response in the lawsuit, their argument is that, well, the language of Article 15 conflicts with something in the Constitution that's older than it. So elsewhere in the Constitution, it specifically says the legislature has the power to refer policy changes to the people. And so they, it's hard to think about how to phrase this, but I suppose they're making the argument that that part of Article 15 itself is unconstitutional, or at least is clearly in conflict with a different part of the Constitution. And then when it comes to the other provision they're accused of violating, when I spoke with legislative counsel, they said, even though there's that provision that says the legislature can't change stuff that passed on the ballot for 7 years unless they clear the two-thirds hurdle, they say that referring a potential amendment to the ballot doesn't count as making a change. It's just sort of providing the option to the public to make the change.
I'm Craig Blumenschein, and you're listening to A Closer Look with the Monitor. My guest is Mary Storer. She's a reporter from the North Dakota Monitor, and we're talking about a potential ballot measure headed for the November election that's now facing a constitutional challenge, and that could stop it before voters ever see it, and it has to do with term limits. And we'll continue our discussion relative, Mary, to the role of the Secretary of State. What role does he have, and why does his office still approve the measure for the ballot?
I talked to Secretary Howe about this, and he said that under state law and some court cases where the Supreme Court has ruled on this area previously, the role of his agency is to just certify ballot proposals when they meet the general requirements and not really try to gatekeep what may or may not be constitutional. So he basically said, there's no reason why his agency should be involved in any capacity other than that. Like, it's just their job to put it on the ballot if it meets the ordinary requirements.
We'll let the Supreme Court and others decide whether or not it's actually constitutional. What are the plaintiffs asking the Supreme Court in reference to time to act, and why are they asking them to act very quickly?
They want the Supreme Court to prevent this proposal from getting on the ballot, or I believe in their complaint they also said if that doesn't work for whatever reason, to not count the votes, or, render the measure of no effect in whatever other appropriate capacity. And so they're calling on the Supreme Court to hopefully take up the case and review it rather quickly, since the general election is coming up later this year.
What options does the Supreme Court have, Mary, at this point?
To speculate, I think they could probably dismiss it outright, or maybe even say, you know, we don't think we're the right venue for this. Take this to the district court level. Or they could take it up and review the case. The other question to consider is, will the Supreme Court answer the question of, is that provision in the Constitution in Article 15 in direct conflict with other parts of the document? When I was talking to Representative Ista about like his take on it, he basically said like he wants them to answer that ultimate question, but courts are very hesitant to decide those issues when they don't have to. So they could figure out a way to deal with this with the case, but also kind of sidestepping that part of it. So they could do a lot of different things, and who knows where.
Mary, since the lawsuit was filed, now legislative leaders have voted to hire outside attorneys to defend the state. A little unusual. What prompted that decision?
So they met earlier this week to decide that, and when I talked to Senator Hogue, the majority leader, he said, well, they want their separate attorneys to handle this case since it's an important constitutional issue potentially, and they want to make sure the legislature has dedicated people to handle it. And even though that meeting, when they were talking about the case, they were in executive session, so we unfortunately don't have the luxury of knowing exactly what they were thinking, but the other part of it could be the lawsuit is against the legislature, but also the Secretary of State's office. So maybe they wanted their own special people to represent their specific interests if they felt that their interests are distinct enough from the Secretary of State's office.
Mary, you pointed out that Majority Leader Hogue called part of the 2022 amendment a direct encroachment, and that's a quote, on legislative power. What did he mean by that, and why is that argument important to the legislature's case?
I think he's worried that if this amendment in full is upheld, that that could potentially allow for future constitutional amendments to take away other powers of the legislature. So I think the legislature is really, or at least the supporters of that Senate resolution 4008 are really interested in kind of defending their ground, because they feel that the amendment Article 15 is sort of chipping away something that they felt was supposed to be theirs.
Mary, Representative Zach Ista was the lone vote against hiring outside lawyers. What were his concerns, both legally and then also fiscally?
So he voted against Senate Resolution 4008. He made it sound like he didn't want to get into this from the start, but he did say he wants the Supreme Court to kind of answer the question here of like who's right. The other thing is that he said that from the standpoint of having competent attorneys to represent the legislature's interests, he said, why hire outside counsel when legislative counsel or the folks at the AG's office would probably do the best job out of anyone in the state, since that's kind of their territory? So he said that would be, in his view, that would be better and also less expensive. And then he also said that he didn't feel like the legislature's interests and viewpoint in the case would be substantially different from the Secretary of State's office. So he just felt it was an unnecessary step to go hire additional people.
You know, from a practical standpoint, this hiring to me seems, the hiring of outside counsel, as though it's a signal about how seriously lawmakers expect this case to be contested. Do you agree with that?
Reading between the lines of what people have told me, that sounds like that's probably right.
Does this at all, the hiring of outside counsel, change the timeline we talked about before as to how quickly and whether the Supreme Court would take the case up?
I don't know. I think that I feel like it's probably all up to the Supreme Court to decide that timeline. If they're going to take the case, and then, you know, they probably have a lot of say as to if they want to take it up. how quickly it would proceed.
Is it unusual, Mary, for the legislature to hire outside attorneys in a dispute that pits the lawmakers directly against a voter-approved constitutional amendment?
That's a good question. I don't know, because I can't think of another time when the lawsuit was over a constitutional measure itself. And that might just be my own lack of
institutional knowledge.
Although, like, I feel like I know that it's very common for them to, for the state to hire outside counsel for litigation. And that includes like constitutional lawsuits, like the lawsuit over the abortion law and then also the transgender care case and so on. So, but yeah, that's a good question. If anyone knows, I'd like to know that too.
That's Mary Stoyer. She's a government and politics reporter for the North Dakota Monitor, helping us unpack a lawsuit that could shape both the November ballot and the future of legislative term limits here in North Dakota. You can always read Mary's full reporting and her colleagues' full reporting at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. And of course, Mary, we're appreciative of your time with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
A closer look with the Monitor continues. We now bring in Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor. That's North Dakota State's newsroom outlet. She joins us periodically on A Closer Look with the Monitor to share what she and her team are working on and to highlight the stories readers should be watching at the Monitor. Of course, you can look at the Monitor, as we've said earlier, anytime at NorthDakotaMonitor.com, where there are no paywalls and no subscriptions required. Amy, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
What else have you and your team been working on, Amy?
Well, this week, Monitor journalists had the opportunity to participate in a training with the Secretary of State's office to learn how to navigate a new system for financial disclosure forms and campaign finance reporting. One thing that's new this year is a requirement for elected and appointed officials to file a statement of interest once a year rather than once every 4 years. And the deadline for those filings is January 31st, so many of these documents are already online, and we got to learn a little bit more from the Secretary of State about how to access them. And then we also learned that for folks that are running for office right now, they have until April 6th to file these documents.
So what is different about these new requirements? Certainly, they're more regular now. And what problem do you think, Amy, is this new requirement trying to solve?
Yeah, there was some new legislation approved in 2025 that I believe was trying to address a concern that the public sometimes has about conflicts of interest among the, elected or appointed officials. And so this legislation just improves the transparency so that anyone can take a look and see what sort of financial connections their elected appointed officials might have. One of the other things that's different with that legislation is that previously these forms were only available if you made an open records request. And so in my experience, if you were just asking for one or two statements, the Secretary of State's office would routinely scan that document and provide it at no charge. But there could be a fee, especially if you were requesting multiple documents. Our experience was ahead of the 2024 election when we requested at the Monitor the statements of interest for all candidates who were going to be on the November ballot. We had to pay $170 to obtain that information. And we also were unable to get it electronically, so we ended up with a lot of stacks of paper. And so the big change for the public and also the media is that now we'll be able to access that information online for free, and you don't have to make an open records request.
And you can find that information through the Secretary of State's website, which is sos.nd.gov. And of course, with technology and transparency that we all expect today, it's kind of high time that this be done. Amy, what do these financial disclosures show?
They're usually like three-page documents. They're pretty short, but they show the principal source of income for the official and their spouse. They also show some other financial interests and any boards that the official and the spouse serve on. It also has a new requirement to disclose some financial relationships that they may have with government agencies.
All right, Amy, what else is the Monitor working on?
Yeah, we're turning more of our focus to 2026 election coverage. We're hearing candidates making some campaign announcements and other officials announcing their retirements. So we're going to continue to track that news as we head closer to the state political conventions.
Two major retirements just this week, the House Majority Leader and also the House Appropriations Committee Chairman. So yes, lots for the Monitor to cover. That's it for today's A Closer Look with the Monitor. Our thanks to Amy Dalrymple for sharing what's ahead for the North Dakota Monitor. And you can find new episodes and follow along every Thursday here on Main Street and at Prairie Public, and every Friday at NorthDakotaMonitor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Talk to you soon, Amy.
Thanks, Craig. Talk to you next week.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and one of the most popular hands-on experiences at North Dakota's Gateway to Science lets visitors do something many have only dreamed about, and that's fly an airplane. Annie Beck, a STEM educator there, joins us again to talk about the spotlight that's on the flight simulator and other aviation-themed exhibits. Annie, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks so much for having me.
Flight Simulator is cool, and it's a standout exhibit at North Dakota Gateway to Science. Can you describe what visitors experience when they step into it?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, since the beginning of humans, flight has always been something that we are jealous of, that other, you know, that other animals can do, and that we wish we could be like the birds and do. And so, I mean, this is an example, or this is an opportunity for you to experience some of that flight. So we have a flight simulator in our gallery. And we have one of our gallery guides as your instructor for the time, guiding you through the experience. So you will have each flight session lasts about 10 minutes, and you'll learn aviation basics. You'll get familiar with terms like pitch and roll and yaw, and you'll start out at the yoke of a Cessna 172 Skyhawk. You'll practice takeoffs and landings. If you are really skillful and want to challenge yourself, we also have other aircraft that you can advance to, like the XJ-300 Red Bull or an F-22 for a thrill. You can also, with the flight simulator, you have the option of choosing where you are flying. So cool. What airport you're flying in and out of, what landmarks you might see, whether you throw through some fly through some turbulence like snow or thunderstorms. One of the nice things, too, is that you don't have to wait in line to be able to do it. We have a sign-up process where there is a QR code right by the exhibit. So you simply scan it and sign up for a 15-minute time slot. And then we ask you get there a few minutes early just to make sure that we are keeping to a schedule. But you can go and explore the rest of the exhibits. And then when it's your time, you can come and take off.
So parents who are maybe considering that, what is this, just another video game? It is not that. Tell us a little more about how it's really educational and also fun.
Yeah, fun is an important part too. But yeah, absolutely. So it is, yeah, not just a video game. We have the whole setup where you are looking at the different gauges. You are looking at altitude. You are looking at pitch. You are looking at all of those same factors that a pilot looks at when they are learning about safety. So a lot of, different science skills like reading gauges and learning about weather and all of those things come into it as well.
So learning about aviation doesn't just stop with the simulator. There's other flight-related exhibits that visitors can explore, like rotocopters and rocket launchers.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a whole area right by the flight simulator that is all geared towards aerospace and space science. So we have things from pressure bottle launchers, where you build up the pressure and then use that air pressure to launch rockets. We have rotocopters, where you build your own helicopter out of paper, and we have paper clips and cups and other materials, and then put them in our wind tunnel and see how they fly. We even have a little bucket target on the top if you want to challenge yourself. And then we also have a table with materials to build paper airplanes and rockets. We have some instructions for if you want some guidance, but then also feeling free to use your own creativity and engineering skills to build your own. And once you are done, We also have two air-powered launchers that you can use to launch your rockets or your airplanes that you made.
Annie, I've had so many guests on Main Street. When I ask them the question, how should one prepare for this particular vocation that might be in engineering or in chemistry or in physics? And they all say STEM stuff, STEM concepts. Make sure that when they're in elementary school or middle school, they're taking science classes, they're understanding STEM as much as they possibly can. It seems to me that aviation is just the perfect place to whet appetites for all of these STEM concepts like physics and engineering and problem solving.
Absolutely. Yeah. Whether you're talking about math and physics, whether you're talking about weather, I mean, there are just engineering. There are so many components that all tie into aviation.
From piloting a Cessna to launching rockets, North Dakota's gateway to science, their aviation exhibits offer science that turns into an adventure. Annie Beck is a STEM educator at North Dakota Gateway to Science, where learning really does take flight. I'll leave it at that, Annie. Thank you so much for joining us on Main
Street. Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on this Thursday's Main Street, a new segment that will air weekly, and I'm really excited about it. Tech with Peck. My longtime friend George Peck will make technology easier for all of us to understand. That's ahead on Main Street, and it follows this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Technology shapes nearly everything we do, from how we work and learn, to how we listen to music and watch movies, and how we tell our stories. So today, Main Street is launching a new segment to help us make sense of it all. Each Thursday, we'll be joined by George Peck for Tech with Peck. George brings together two worlds that don't always meet. Decades behind the microphone in commercial and public radio, and a career in the tech and data world, helping people understand powerful tools like Tableau, which is a business analytics and data visualization software system, at Salesforce, where George is a distinguished account solutions engineer.
There you go.
And he's also a prolific author, a radio DJ, and the creator of his own online radio station, Etherside.live. George joins us now to kick off Tech with Peck. George, my longtime friend, welcome to Main Street.
Yeah, and tech hasn't changed radio. You and I are still in the same radio studio live on the air right across from each other at the table, right?
That's right. George and I are just sitting here having a nice conversation. George and I grew up in Riverton, Wyoming. And George, I want to introduce you to our listeners. Am I right to remember that radio was actually your first love, long before computer hardware and software and data really even existed in our lives?
Yeah, so there was election night 1972. My family was in the newspaper business at that time. They no longer are, I mean, surprisingly enough, but they were in the newspaper business. And every election night, the town would kind of surround the newspaper office, and the radio station would come and do a remote from there and do election returns. So the newsman of the little local radio station in my hometown was there doing the election returns. J. Larry Hedrick, and I met him, and we chat. He says, well, come down to the station. I'll show you around. That was election night, 1972. Christmas Eve, 1972 was my first day on the air there. I was in ninth grade. I was 14 years old, and that was my first foray into radio. So to just kind of anticipate your next question, that was when program logs, so radio stations always had live people on the air. There was no automation, so there was always live people. And what guided us and what we needed to play, the commercials we needed to play, the order we needed to play, was the program log. And the program log was written out by hand every day. I went to Casper, Wyoming, in the summer of 1977 to work at a pretty hot top 40 AM station, KATI. The hand log was, or that program log was written by hand. I graduated college, went to Billings, Montana, to Cook Radio, KOOK, powerhouse top 40 radio station, sat down to do my first shift, and there was a pile of green bar computer paper on the desk with the program log. And in essence, that was the beginning of my career change.
Seems like just yesterday to me, George, but it's been a while ago.
Yeah.
All right. So we've talked about creating this segment, and I kept coming back in my mind to one idea, and that's helping people understand technology without talking over them. And I can't think of anyone that I've heard or that I know that can help our listeners get a lot out of this weekly conversation. George, this is what you kind of do. You explain very technical things to people in your work.
The new title, the new Distinguished Solution Engineers, it's a fancy title. The funny story is that I ended up in one part of this organization called the Center of Excellence on October 1st. On October 28th, we had a meeting, and someone from an enablement group, which is the fancy term we use internally for training, wanted some help with the project, and we had a quick chat, and the next day, my manager said, guess what? The enablement person went and lobbied to get you on her team, and you're now going to go be an enablement full-time person. So that's my full-time position, is enabling. Now, I'm enabling our internal sales teams, but they need the help as much or more than our customers do. So that is now my position, is enabling, which is explaining the tech to our own sales teams and our other solution engineers so they know how to go sell it.
A lot of people hear a lot of words from you like data and AI and analytics and immediately might tune out. But I've now watched you, George, do your work. How do you approach making technology, complex technology, reachable for folks like me?
So I put myself kind of in your place. Here's the thing that I immediately think about. I will have any number of people tell me when I'm planning an enablement session or planning a webcast or planning a video or whatever I do, oh, you don't have to cover that. People already know that. And I immediately say, wrong. Okay. The second I say people already know that, I failed them. So I would much rather have someone already know that and have to hear it again than not already know that and get lost. So my first step is to assume that my audience doesn't already know it and they need to learn it. And the second assumption is if I can put myself in their place and think about what they need to know and how they can apply what I'm going to show them to their day or their account or their use case or their demo, then that's what I'm going to do. So I put myself in their place. I consider what it needs, what we need to do to make sure that each of these things are easy to understand. And then I kind of build. I'll start with one concept, then we'll go on and I'll reiterate that concept as I go to the next concept. So I'm building that knowledge, reiterating the knowledge before, and it just flows very nicely and builds that knowledge.
George is talking to me from the studio in his home. A couple stories below where he is sitting is this fantastic home studio. It's a movie theater unlike any other I've ever seen. And George has put all of this stuff together himself, and he will then be able to explain things like digital television, projectors, sound systems, lighting in his theater, how he sets up his internet connections, and all of these tech things that scare many of us. George, over the next few weeks, is going to be able to make it understandable for all of us. George, we have a lot that we can talk about.
Yeah, we do. And it's interesting. I mean, the thing that it's kind of like a YouTube channel. I mean, how much do you want to narrow and what things do you want to discuss? I got a Tesla in the garage, so we could get, you know, that could take us in a certain direction. I got this audio video studio I'm in right now. I'm looking at you through a teleprompter to a Panasonic GH5. I have a Neumann and a Sennheiser microphone in here. I have a Logitech audio console. I have a Blackmagic video switcher. That's upstairs. Downstairs is the theater with the JVC projector and the Stewart screen and the Marantz AVR. We can go in all kinds of directions just depending on what we think folks might find interesting.
That's right, and we'll do that Thursdays. I'm visiting with my good friend George Peck. He and I are creating this thing that we're going to bring to our listeners called Tech with Peck. I'm really looking forward to this conversation that we get to have. I want people to remember that you've also worked at public radio stations in Colorado at KCNC and at KUVO. There are probably other public radio stations that I don't know about that I'm missing. And you have a knowledge of who our audience might be, I think, maybe more so than most.
Well, I hope so. So KUVO is a pretty unique organization. This is a radio station that still plays classic jazz 24/7 for the most part. And that is very unique. When I first moved to Colorado from Los Angeles, I heard that and was very captivated by it. So I volunteered for them for the better part of 16 years, including prior to COVID-19, which changed the industry tremendously. Prior to COVID-19, I did my shows remotely. That all changed with COVID, and that's much more common, but I did it before that. And I mean live. I was in my studio in this room on the air in Denver, which is 45 miles away from here in Fort Collins. So that radio station was a very unique offering and still is. And then the second station I did is a station called the Colorado Sound. That's how they brand. And it's a station that does what we call adult album alternative. So it used to be kind of the album rock radio of the 70s and 80s, but now it's adult album music, no commercials. I'm pitching it already, and I'm not even doing a fundraiser, but it's music that is, I mean, it's new and it's very unique. And it's, that's very much what's driven my internet station, is that kind of adult album alternative approach. So yeah, I've been doing a little bit of work with public radio since about 2001.
I'm going to allow you, George, to pick any topic you would like for us to talk about next week.
Yeah, it's hard. God, I don't know if we want to talk about AI yet, Craig. Do we even want to get into that yet? Let's put that off. Let's do this. Let's talk about home theater next week.
I love it. I have a short throw projector. George knows a little bit about that. I have my own little system that doesn't hold a candle to George Peck's system. He's my friend. This is Tech with Peck. It's a new weekly segment that we're airing Thursdays here on Main Street. We'll be talking about technologies that shape our lives, our work, our creativity, always with an eye towards what it means for us. George, it's great to have you with us here, and welcome to Main Street.
Oh, this is going to be a lot of fun, man. I'm looking forward to it. So, next week, home theater.
Home theater.
Come on back.
I have a feeling this could be a multi-part segment, George, with home theater. There's a lot to talk about.
It's very possible. There's a lot there.
The Cinema 100 Winter Film Series continues on Thursday, January 15th with 9 more films, including Sentimental Value, the Iranian film It Was Just an Accident, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, and the American 1970s classic Chinatown. Each film is shown twice on Thursdays at 3 and 6 p.m. at the Grand 22 Theater in Bismarck. More information on the entire series is available at the Cinema 100 Facebook page. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally, working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Main Street continues. On this Thursday, we bring in our news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. Dave, it's nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you, Craig. Nice to hear yours.
Of course, the legislature concluded their special session last week. We'll get to that in just a minute, Dave. But two key legislative leaders now have announced their retirement from the legislature. First, Majority Leader Representative Mike LaFleur. Dave, what do you know about that?
All I know is that it came out of nowhere. And I'm thinking, you know, he's saying, you know, he served well as the majority leader. And he might think it might be time to try something else, you know, something else, or concentrate on his business. But we don't know much more than that, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him since. But I was surprised, like a lot of people were surprised about that.
What was your feeling of him as the North Dakota House Majority Leader?
He kept his hand on the till, so to speak, pretty steady hand, allowed people to talk, allowed people to take responsibility and take ownership of some of their leadership positions. I think he was more of a collaborative leader, and I think that bodes well for the legislative session.
Another longtime North Dakota lawmaker, the House Appropriations Chair, has also announced his retirement. Dave, who is he, and tell me about him?
Don Vigasaw from Cooper Sound, North Dakota. His day job, so to speak, when he's not a legislator, he was a car dealer, but he was a very steady hand, very knowledgeable about appropriations, knew the ins and outs, and a really nice person to deal with. Always liked talking to him, whether it be about appropriations matters or about cars, because he always asked me what kind of car I had and things like that. That's North Dakota, because people who are in the legislature have lives outside the legislature.
They certainly do. It's a citizen legislature. Not many states do it that way. Wyoming was one of those states that also had a citizen legislature, and it takes a lot for someone to leave something like their car business and then want to serve.
Right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because there's been some concern recently about security issues, and I know the North Dakota legislators have had to look at things like not publishing their email addresses, or perhaps going as far as not publishing their addresses, but they say, you know, if you try not to publish our addresses, most people know who we are anyway, so that's a big thing. But, you know, taking the email off the public rolls so you can't access their email probably is a good step. But I'm thinking the security concerns go back also in North Dakota when they had the protest at the pipeline. They put in magnetometers at the Capitol, which we were ahead of Minnesota in doing that. That's an interesting distinction.
Dave, let's move on to the North Dakota Ethics Commission. We spoke about them recently. The commission has adopted now several updates to its complaint process and includes a rule that allows complaints to be filed in bad faith to be dismissed.
That's right, the bad faith exception, because that was a main complaint about some legislators that their opponents or some of their opponents were weaponizing complaints against them. So if the Ethics Commission now has the authority to find those and who are going to bring these maybe prove to be nothing complaints. And they've had a few of those.
Dave, lawmakers will face hard budget decisions in the upcoming session. Let's first talk about the reason why, and then already what's happening for budget planning. First, what are lawmakers worried about of having less money to work with in the upcoming biennium?
Well, let's talk about one of the underlying issues is the fact that oil prices have gone down. They've crept back up recently, but there's less, perhaps, tax money coming into the state. There's another concern, which I didn't think about until I was talking to Brad Beckendall in Williston, and you talked to the mayor, Howard Klug, about this, that in Williston, a lot of sales tax is oil-related. So oil prices go down, oil companies are not buying as much, sales taxes go down. So there's a little, you know, basically squeezing of the budget at that point.
Dave, the Office of Management and Budget, has now began budget considerations, I guess, and having meetings to look at what's ahead relative to the state coffers.
That's right. And these actually started as kind of collaborations between the governor's office, OMB, and state agencies. And this was back when we had a lot of money. They were wondering what kind of big picture things you're looking at, what kind of things you like to see, and they talk about that. This time, they're going to go to the agency and say, hey, budget's going to be tight. If you have to, and they're not saying that they have to do any allotments at this point, but if you have to cut back, where are you going to cut back? Or how can you frame your request in a smaller budget environment? So it's not new. This is a commodity-based budget. You've seen it in the mid-2015s, too, where you had allotments. So there's some concern there. Right now they say things are looking okay, but don't expect the windfalls that we've seen lately.
Dave, you've had now almost a week to reflect on the special session that was. What were your conclusions and what were your takeaways? What do you want us to be thinking about?
Okay, really, think about the main issue about why they're there, and that was the idea of improving rural health care. They did very well on that. But I'm still kind of shaking my head a little bit at the legislature deciding not to pass a school lunch bill. And they say, well, let's just bring it on. Let them put it in the Constitution. Now, the concern is that if you put it in the Constitution, legislators have no control over how much money you spend on it, or very little control. I do think that there's some clause that is in the initiated constitutional measure to have some kind of legislative oversight on it. But there's a concern legislators had that, you know, you put things in the Constitution, it's hard to get them out.
Yet they didn't want to add it to Century Code, and now it will be in the voters' hands this coming November, more likely than not.
And the thing that really got to me, too, is that there were legislators who were saying, oh, no, we don't believe the polls, or our polls are showing something different. Well, the polls are showing that if it goes to the voters in November, it will be passed. So they could have gotten out front of this. And I know that was Representative Nathy's plan. but they aren't getting out front of it.
Dave, what I'll be most interested to see is what opposition surfaces relative to this free lunch vote that voters in North Dakota will have a chance to vote on this coming November, and who funds it, if we can tell. And I think that will tell a lot about the whether or not this will be highly contested.
I think you're absolutely right. So it'll be interesting to watch any particular ads that come out on paid media or Facebook posts or things like that, and also in the campaign disclosures that have to be filed with the Secretary of State's office.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news on Thursdays here on Main Street. Dave, I wish you a good week next week. Have a nice weekend.
I will. You too. Thanks. I'll tell you a story.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 29th. The last Wolverine recorded in North Dakota was M56, identified in 2016 after it was killed by a McKenzie County rancher. M56 had been radio-collared in Wyoming, detected in Colorado, and then its signal was lost. Wolverines had not been verified in the state for 150 years. Red River fur traders at Pembina included wolverine pelts in their inventories through the early 1800s, taken from a large territory that included parts of Canada. In what is now North Dakota, the species was found in the Pembina Hills and other areas with heavy snow cover, including Turtle Mountain. Although thought to be extirpated by the mid-1800s, various sightings or kills were reported into the early 1900s at Turtle Mountain. Newspaper advertisements aimed at attracting land buyers, fishermen, and hunters listed wolverine as late as 1906. In December of 1905, an advertisement for lots at Lake Upsilon stated, 5 years ago, Dr. Thor Moeller told people that Lake Upsilon had all the natural advantages to make the finest summer resort in the world. Experts from the East declare that if it were in the Adirondacks, every lot could be easily sold at $1,000. The ad said lots were selling for $10, but it would cost $25 the following year, adding, the nearest railroad station is in St. John, 7 miles away, but as this branch is now being extended into Canada, it'll be less than 3 miles to the railroad, and there will probably be a spur built right into the lake. Picking up the pace, the ad continued, there's birch, ash, oak, and poplar. There is the clear, fresh air of 2,500 feet. There's deer, bear, wolf, wildcat, lynx, and wolverine. There's sable, otter, mink, fox, muskrat, badger, woodchuck, rabbit, and several varieties of squirrel. There's also partridge, grouse, and ducks in abundance. There is the softest, clearest, and most palatable water in the world. There's fishing for black bass, pickerel, and lake trout. There's bathing on the finest gravel shores. What more do you want? 1 year later, the same ad was still running, but at a more sedate and grammatically dignified pace, employing a poetic, therapeutic overhaul of the original language. It ended by urging readers, now is the time to investigate and select your lots. Plats shown by and lots can be purchased from Dr. Thor Moeller. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lee Serdrick. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Swing into an afternoon of music, movement, and fun with the Minot Symphony Orchestra on Saturday, February 7th at 3 p.m. as they present Carnegie Hall's Link Up, The Orchestra Swings. This interactive performance features works of Duke Ellington, George Gershwin, Florence Price, Wynton Marsalis, and more, plus a special MSO and MSU side-by-side festival collaboration. More information and tickets can be found online at MinotSymphony.com.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's a re-air of The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. And at 7 p.m. Central, we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us, have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week back here on Main Street.